Just a friendly reminder to everyone that today, as we be asking everyone to please not record this event. We have an event approval form, and out of respect for our speaker and as a student organization, we're telling you guys to please not record this event, and to please be mindful and respectful of one another, and there will be a forum for a Q&A at the end of the session, and also to have respect for one another and not to interrupt Miko during his speech. Just to introduce Miko to us shortly, he is an Israeli peace activist and writer who dares to say in public what others still choose to deny. He is credibly so when he debunks myths that news from the world told with mind loyalty. People listen. In 1997, Miko's 13-year-old niece was killed in a suicide attack in Jerusalem. This pushed Miko to learn about the conflict and engage with his Palestinian neighbor to learn what can be done to stop the killing of innocent people. He's about to publish his book, The General's Son, a personal narrative of an Israeli discovering Palestine. The book and the presentation is about his journey and the discoveries he made. So please give a warm welcome to Miko.
Thank you all for being here tonight. A little disclaimer before we start. Things I'm going to say are going to be difficult for some of you to hear. If you come here expecting to hear a balanced presentation, then I suggest you go home. This is not a balanced situation, and therefore this is not going to be a balanced presentation. I want to thank Students for Justice in Palestine for the tremendous work that they do for peace and justice. Of course, for inviting me here tonight and putting together this the Palestine Awareness Week, which I think is very, very important. I also want to thank the members of the Jewish Zionist community who are here. I'm sure that you will review the notes that you take. I know how you feel. I know how Jews and Zionists feel because I came from a very Zionist background, probably more Zionist. In many ways, probably more Jewish than many of the
Zionists off.
Tonight. My grandfather signed the Israeli Declaration of Independence.
I am doing it.
My father was a general in the Israeli army. He was among the planners and executors of some of Israel's most defining military victories, specifically in 1948 and 1967. So I know what Zionists are taught. And I know how Zionists think. But it's time to sweep away the Zionist myths and to uncover the truth so that we can all finally live in peace. To fully understand the conflict, we need to begin at the beginning. And so I'm going to address three myths tonight. The first one is the myth of 1948. The second one will be the myth of the existential threat 1967, and then finally the myth of the Jewish democracy. I'm going to start with a full passage from my book, which as you heard, will be coming out pretty soon. Can everybody hear me okay? Is this better? So here I'm going to quote. Growing up in Israel, we were taught to believe that the Arabs left Eretz Israel partly on their own, and partly at the directive of their so-called leaders. And that therefore, taking their land and taking their homes was morally okay. It never occurred to us that even if they did leave willingly, we had no rights to prohibit their return. But then, Israeli historians found that just as Palestinians have been saying for decades, this was not true. And it's interesting that when Palestinians claim something for many, many years, it's discounted. But then Israeli historians come and claim the exact same thing, and then it's given credibility. So Israeli historians confirmed that when Israel was created, it was in fact created
on the ruins of Palestine. Now, although Palestine was not a state yet, it would have become one had it not been so thoroughly destroyed. It had cities where commerce and trade were taking place. There was a middle class. There were Palestinian judges and scholars. There was a rich political life and a culture that was unique and set the Palestinians apart. What the Palestinians didn't have, the one thing the Palestinians never invested in, was a military. And so, even though they could have constituted the vast majority of the population in Palestine at the time, when the Jewish militias attacked them, they were helpless. The Jewish community, on the other hand, and we're talking about Palestine 60, 70 years ago, the Jewish community at the time was very small. It was less than 500,000 people. But they had developed its own state-like institutions. And they were separate from the Palestinians. This was based on the principle of the Hebrew word hafradah, which means segregation. So the Jewish population built their own schools, they developed their own healthcare system, a nationalized healthcare system, in fact. They had a quasi-government, of which my grandfather was a member, and they had a very strong, very well-trained, and well-indoctrinated militia, of which my father was a part as a young man. This militia was dedicated to creating a Jewish state in Palestine, completely disregarding that the vast majority of the population were Palestinians. In 1948, that same Jewish militia became the Israeli army. But between the end of 1947 and the beginning of 1949, they destroyed close to 500 towns and villages and exiled close to 800,000 Palestinians who to this day are not permitted to return to their homes. So it turns out that Israel had not, after all, been a haphazard fight in which the Arabs fled their homes due to the directives of their own leaders. It was an unprovoked, systematic campaign of ethnic cleansing led by the Jewish militia. It involved massacres, it involved terrorism, and it involved the wholesale looting of an entire nation. My mother always used to tell me the story about the homes of the Palestinians in the neighborhoods in Jerusalem, in West Jerusalem. The Palestinians in West Jerusalem were forced to leave, and their homes, they're still there, beautiful, spacious homes, were vacated, and Jewish families were invited to offer these homes. And my mother was offered one of these homes, especially since her husband was an officer and he was fighting. But she couldn't take it. She said she wasn't able, she could not bring herself to take the home of a family that was forced out and will not be living in a refugee camp. She said the coffee was still warm on their table as the Jewish soldiers came in and began looting. She remembers the truckloads of loot taken by the Israeli soldiers from these homes. To this day, of course, none of the Palestinians were permitted to return. Then once the state was established, Israel had worked tirelessly to efface the remnants of prior Palestinian existence by, again, demolishing towns and villages, demolishing historic sites, and then ruining an estimated 2,000 mosques. I recall there was a TV series in Israel several years ago called Tkuma. Tkuma means rebirth. It was a very long series, very involved, and it was put together by the Israeli television. And in one interview, they interviewed one of the brigade commanders from 1948. And he was asked if it's true that the Jewish militias burned down Palestinian villages. And this man, who was older now, he looked up at the camera and he said, "They burned like bonfires. They burned like bonfires." After the war was over, the Palestinians who did remain within the newly created state, of course, had to become citizens of the state that was forced upon them. And they were designated as the Arabs of Israel, the Arabs of the land of Israel. A designation that, of course, does not give them their own national identity and allows Israel to deny them their own rights as individuals and the rights of the nation. So they are Arabs in a Jewish state, and they're citizens of a state that is despised by all its neighbors. Another widely accepted Zionist myth is that in the 1967 war, Israel had to defend itself against an existential threat that was posed by invading Arab armies. The Arab armies were about to wipe it off the face of the earth. And it just so happened that miraculously, the Israelis were able to win and conquer the lands to the north, east, and south, and to defeat these three massive armies. Now, setting aside for a moment the fact that countless books have been written in Hebrew, English, Arabic, and other languages, and that documentaries were filmed that disprove this myth completely and clearly show that Israel attacked in order to conquer in 1967, as part of the research of my book, I spent days at the Israeli Army Archives, reading through the minutes of the meetings of the Israeli Army top brass, of the general staff. I want to read to you another quote from my upcoming book. If you know anything about these times, the months and weeks and days that led up to the 1967 war, it's fascinating. In a stormy meeting of the IDF top brass and the Israeli cabinet that took place on the 2nd of June, 1967, my father, General Monty Pettit, told the cabinet in no uncertain terms that the Egyptians needed at least a year and a half in order to be ready for a full-scale war. His point was that the time to strike a devastating blow against the Egyptian army was now, not because of an existential threat, but because the Egyptian army is not prepared for war. And the other generals agreed. But the cabinet, the Israeli government, was hesitant. The prime minister was not sure that a full-scale war was the right thing to do, and a tug-of-war of unimaginable proportion took place between these two power structures, the IDF top brass and the Israeli cabinet. During that stormy meeting, my father accused the prime minister and said, he's talking about Nasser, the Egyptian president at the time, Gamal Abdel Nasser. He says, Nasser is counting on you being hesitant. He's convinced that we will not strike. Your hesitation is working in his advantage. Later on, that meeting, he accused the prime minister of insulting the Israeli army, an army that had won every single war and had won every single battle, and yet they're not being allowed to attack. So during these many, many meetings, but during this particular one, there was no mention of an existential threat, but an opportunity to once again assert Israeli strength. Years later, by the way, this was confirmed by the other generals when they were out of uniform, including the famous butcher, Ariel Sharon. In the end, of course, as we all know, the war did begin. The Israeli cabinet succumbed to the enormous pressure placed on them by the generals, and they approved a preemptive strike against Egypt that began on June 5th, 1967. And again, I'd like to quote, "The surprise attack led to the total destruction of Egypt's air force, the decimation of the Egyptian army, the reconquest of Gaza Strip and the Sinai Peninsula in a matter of days. The Israeli army knew also that the Syrian army was in shambles, and that the Jordanians were no match for the IDF strength. After the campaign against Egypt went so smoothly, the generals turned their attention to the West Bank and to the Golan Heights, two regions Israel has coveted for many years. Both these regions have strategic water resources and hills overlooking Israeli territory. And of course, the West Bank contains the heartland of biblical Israel and the crown jewel, the old city of Jerusalem. And in 6 days it was over. In 6 days it was all over. Arab casualties are estimated at 15,000. 15,000 dead in 6 days. Israeli casualties, 700. And the territory that was controlled by Israel after the war had nearly tripled in size. Israel had in its possession not only the land, and the resources it had wanted for a long time, but also the largest stockpiles of Russian-made arms outside of Russia. And once again, of course, Israel had asserted itself as a major regional power, or in other words, as the neighborhood bully. Now here's something that happened right as the war ended, something of immense importance. And remember, this was 45 years ago. At the first week of the meeting of the General Staff after the Six-Day War, Chief of Staff Yitzhak Rabin, who was later, as you know, Prime Minister, was beaming with the glory of victory. But when the meeting was nearing its end, my father raised his hand. He was called on, he spoke of the unique chance the victory offered to solve the Palestinian problem once and for all. For the first time, he said, in Israel's history, we are face to face with the Palestinians without any Arab countries between us. Now, he said, we have a chance to offer the Palestinians a state of their own in the West Bank and Gaza. He claimed with certainty that holding on to the West Bank and the people who lived in it was contrary to Israel's long-term strategy. There was no way to be a Jewish democracy and have millions and millions of Palestinians under control. Popular resistance to the occupation, he said, was sure to arise, and Israel's army would be used to quell the resistance with disastrous and demoralizing results. It would turn the Jewish state into an increasingly brutal occupying power and eventually into a binational state, exactly the reality we are living today. There was not a single settlement then. So of course, this was nothing short of prophetic. Today, of course, like I said, we live in this reality. As he was saying this, of course, the future leaders of the Intifada were still in their cradles. Of course, his words were ignored, and his claims were brushed aside, and instead, blinded by their newly gained access to mythical biblical places like Hebron and Bethlehem and Shiloh and Shechem, Israeli leaders began a massive settlement project to bring Jews into the newly conquered land. Several years later, early 1970s, my father called on Israel to negotiate with the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization. He claimed Israel needed to talk with whoever represented the Palestinian people, the people with whom we share this land. He believed only peace with the Palestinians could ensure Israel's continued existence as a state that was both Jewish and democratic. Now, after all these years, of course people talk about a two-state solution and a Palestinian state, but in the West Bank, but now this opportunity, this possibility no longer exists. The myth of Israel being a democracy is another myth that's being perpetuated, even in light of overwhelming evidence to the contrary. While Jewish Israelis, and I'm sure APAC members here, like to think that Jews are the only rightful citizens of their land, and will argue that Israel is a shining example, thank you, of democracy, this is actually far from being true. For example, Israel has been in control of the West Bank for over four decades and has built and invested in the West Bank massively. The Palestinians, who make up the majority of the population of the West Bank, are excluded from any of it. In other words, 100% of the construction in the West Bank was done to bring Jews into the West Bank and exclude the 3 million or so Palestinians whose land this belongs to in the first place. 3 million Palestinians are left out, disenfranchised, even as they see their lands being taken, their homes destroyed, and roads, malls, schools, and gated communities being built for Jews only, with no access to them or their families. So this is some democracy. But that, of course, is not the worst of it. Water, the scarcest of resources, is controlled and distributed by the Israeli Water Authority, including the huge amounts of water that exist within the West Bank. According to B'Tselem, the Israeli Human Rights Organization, the groundwater from the mountain aquifer is inside the West Bank. It is a shared water source for Israelis and Palestinians. It is the largest and the highest quality water source in the area, producing 600 million cubic meters of water annually. There's a lot of statistics, but it's important. It's interesting. Israel holds almost complete control of the aquifer and exploits 80% of the production for its needs, leaving the remainder for Palestinian use. And I quote from Ritzeben, "The discriminatory and unfair division of shared water resources creates a chronic water shortage in the West Bank." So in other words, Palestinians have to buy their own water back from Israel, because Israel doesn't recognize the rights, the Palestinians' rights to the water that is under their land. So it becomes an absurd thing when a Palestinian farmer cannot dig, is not permitted to dig a well on his own land to use for his own farm. Now, when you look at it as how the distribution is actually made, it's even more alarming. Israel distributes the water like this. Per capita, Israeli Jews receive about 300 cubic meters of water per year. The Palestinians receive 85 cubic meters of water per year, and the World Health Organization recommends 100 cubic meters of water per year per capita. But that's not all. The Jewish settlers in the West Bank are allocated per capita 1,500 cubic meters of water per year. In other words, and if you've been there, you've seen this, while Palestinians have barely enough to drink, the Jewish settlers, maybe not 500 yards away, have swimming pools and green lawns. So, does anybody really take this seriously when people say it's a democracy? I mean, does anybody really think that this can go on forever? Of course, now, in light of the people's uprising in the Middle East, certainly we can expect to see dictatorial regimes falling like dominoes. So can we expect that 500 Palestinians will continue to live under a regime that is democratic for Jews, perhaps, but is brutally oppressive towards Palestinians? There are, what, about 6 million Jews and about 5 million Palestinians living on the land. Maybe 5.5 million Palestinians. Sharing the same country, but living under two different sets of laws. So, this is a democracy. My father, who was a military man, spent his days after he retired from the military fighting for justice for the Palestinian cause. And he was often asked about the question of Palestinian terrorism. And here's what he once said in an interview on Israeli television. He was asked about this. And he said this: "Terrorism is a terrible thing. But the fact remains that when a small nation is ruled by a larger power, terror is the only means at their disposal. This has always been true," he said, "and I fear this will always be the case." Of course, on this particular issue, the Palestinians have elevated themselves above most nations, and they are engaged in a fierce, some of you may know this, of course, they're engaged in a fierce nonviolent resistance campaign. Even though they're forced and they're faced with brutal force by the Israeli army, I think they will succeed, and not unlike the people of Egypt who kicked out a brutal regime, the people of Palestine will end up doing the same. You see, my father's predictions, interestingly enough, have come true. And the work again of the Israeli lobby and AIPAC in this country notwithstanding, people around the world are beginning to realize that there are in fact two nations that live between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, and the brutal regime under which Palestinians live is no longer acceptable. And speaking of the Israeli lobby, I remember seeing many of you guys at the vigil that was held a couple of months ago at Gilboa Park. It was a vigil that was held to remember the innocent victims killed by Israel in Gaza. You were there draped with Israeli flags, singing and dancing, as the rest of us were there, separated by a row of police and a sense of morality, trying to recall the names of over 1,400 dead, innocent civilians, police officers, children, women and men who were killed by the State of Israel in a matter of 3 days. Those are 3 weeks of such death and destruction that one can hardly comprehend. I recall stories of the Israeli Air Force pilots who flew sortie after sortie, dumping hundreds of tons of bombs on Gaza, exposing the civilian population to unimaginable horror, and then returning home to their families to celebrate the festival of Hanukkah. You see, the attacks took place during the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah. And then these pilots, having enjoyed the celebration, slept well in their homes, in their beds, only to get up the next morning and then do it again and again and again. And I recall that those of you that were at the vigil draped with the flag, dancing around, you held signs that said, "But the Israelis warned the Palestinians." The army dropped thousands of leaflets warning the Palestinians that this was coming, that this nightmare was about to begin. I can only imagine the mother who saw the warnings, knowing that the death and destruction were pending, and knowing also that there was nowhere to go. There was nowhere to take the children, nowhere to hide from the bombs, from the fire, from the smoke, from the chemicals and from the phosphorus that melts the flesh and won't be extinguished. Nowhere to go because Israel imposed a siege on Gaza, a never-ending lockdown on the people of Gaza. So for these young Israeli Air Force pilots, young men that most Zionist Jews and Israelis consider their finest, this was nothing more than shooting fish in a barrel, as they began this merciless onslaught at precisely 11:25 in the morning on December 27, 2008. They dropped 100 tons of bombs in the first 9 hours. 100 tons of bombs in the first 9 hours in one of the most densely populated areas in the world. And I tell you today, December 27, 2008 will be remembered as the darkest and most shameful day in the long history of the Jewish people. It was a day when the Jewish state committed horrendous and shameful crimes by dropping hundreds of tons of bombs at the precise time that the children in Gaza were out on the streets. Between 11 and 11:30 in the morning, 800,000 children of Gaza are either on the way to school or on the way home, as that is when the two shifts of the school switch. This was the time chosen by Israeli decision makers to begin the assault. I want to read to you a little passage from one of the best books ever written about the Middle East. It's called The Tribes Triumphant by reporter Charles Glass. Charles Glass is an excellent writer, and he was a reporter. He worked in the Middle East for many, many years. And he describes Gaza and the children of Gaza. He describes them on the way to school in the morning. In smocks of blue and gray, little girls with white fringe collars, boys leading their younger brothers with canvas bags of books on their backs, hairs brushed back and faces scrubbed. Thousands and thousands of children's feet padding the dusty paths between their mother's front doors and their schools. Gaza is a children's land. Beautiful youngsters, so innocent they could laugh even in Gaza. These are the people, these are the children who were attacked on that day, on that dark day in December. So those of you who are here because you support Israel's brutality will no doubt claim Israel had a right to do this. Was acting in self-defense. Israel was acting in self-defense because of thousands and thousands of rockets that were shot into Israel by Hamas militants in Gaza. Let me tell you something about Qassam rockets. I was in a kibbutz with my relative just north of Gaza on a Saturday afternoon with my children as the rockets began flying over us. The alarms went off. It was frightening. I was there last December. And last December, a Qassam rocket again fell on the same kibbutz by the kindergarten. When kids were present, children were present. They were outside. There was glass everywhere. Children were hurt. They were bleeding. Some kids had to be taken to the hospital. Some were in shock. I saw the hole in the ground like an oversized soccer ball. Scary stuff. And as I looked at the hole in the ground, I was reminded what it looks like, what the crater made by a one-ton bomb looks like. It's the size of a city block. Children don't suffer shock. They don't suffer scratches. They're decimated. And they're burned. And they're buried in the rubble. And they're suffocated by the fumes. Now you multiply that by 100, and multiply it again, and multiply it again. And keep in mind again that Gaza population, the population density, is one of the highest in the world. Yet, the Israeli lobby will justify this. Supporters of Israel and AIPAC will justify this. Perhaps those of you here that are Jewish might be familiar with the story in the book of Genesis, chapter 18, when God decides to destroy the city of Sodom because they were evil. And Abraham, our patriarch, our shared patriarch, by the way, the shared patriarch of Arabs and Jews, he chastises God. He walks up and he chastises God, and he said, Will thou destroy the righteous with the wicked? Perhaps there are 50 righteous within the city. And God promises Abraham he will spare the city if he finds 50 righteous people. But in Israel today, there is no Abraham. And in Israeli eyes, no Palestinians are righteous. Not even children. Because as we know, the 800,000 children living in Gaza were not spared that horror. Hard to imagine. You know, I'm often accused of being one-sided.
No.
And I'm often accused of not mentioning Palestinian terrorism. Well, I will say something about terrorism. As my father said decades ago, when a small nation is ruled by a larger power, some form of violent resistance is to be expected. And the victims are always innocent. As for my own family's brush with terrorism, it was the thing that drove us to learn more about the conflict and reach out to Palestinians. The drive for me, the final push for me, to reach out to Palestinians came as a result of this devastating tragedy. And I'll read you another passage from my book. In the fall of 1997, there was a disaster. My niece Madar was killed by Palestinian suicide bombers. She was 13 years old. Hours later, there we were, driving along the road to the cemetery. Police escorted our procession on motorcycles, making way for the vans carrying the devastated family members of another Jewish casualty. As we got out of the van, someone approached me and asked me to carry the small coffin. My heart felt far heavier than the heartbreakingly slight weight on my shoulders. Israelis and Palestinians, family members and friends from across the political spectrum, famous leaders and ordinary people, came to give eulogies and to express their sorrow at this unspeakable loss. Smadar was laid to rest near my father, her grandfather, in a small hilltop cemetery just outside Jerusalem. To this day, my sister Nurit cannot forgive herself for leaving her baby girl alone in the cold, damp ground. But when my sister Nurit did come out of her room to meet the mourners, she did not ask for retaliation. She didn't beg for revenge. Instead, she said this. She said, no real mother would want the same horror to happen to another mother. I stayed in Jerusalem for the week of the Shabbat, the 7 days of mourning, and it wasn't easy to come home and resume our routines after it was all over. You wonder, how do people do this? How do people keep on living as though nothing had happened? How many songs have been sung, poems read, and stories written about this feeling one has when the unthinkable happens, how and the world somehow doesn't end. It seemed impossible to carry on, But another thing my mother always says is that life is stronger than death. And so, of course, we go on. But something had changed. I felt I had to do something, and I knew that meeting with Palestinians was the right thing to do. And so I did, and I began right here in San Diego. And I was welcomed by the warm embrace of the local Palestinian community, some of whom are here tonight. The experience of meeting Palestinians, for me, was comforting, it was liberating, and it was also heart-wrenchingly difficult. It was comforting because I realized that we were similar. And it was liberating because I realized we don't have to be enemies. But it was heart-wrenchingly difficult because I realized I did not have full possession of the truth. And in many ways, those of you that are here, Jewish Zionists that are here today, you are not in full possession of the truth. And I suggest that you get over it. And I suggest that you join me in what was very eloquently called by the great Clovis Maksud, the constituency of conscience. You know, one can only imagine what it was like for whites in South Africa when they saw apartheid falling apart, trying as hard as they could to hold on to their dying way of life, corrupt as it was. And one can only imagine the white racists in the southern states were going through the same thing as legalized racism and discrimination came to an end in this country. And of course, we see brutal tyrants everywhere these days, from Libya all across to the Gulf states, doing the same thing, holding on, even as they fall one after the other. Zionists and Zionist supporters, you guys are the same. You're holding on to the notion that a racist regime can last, that injustice can carry on, that the crimes against others who are different can go unpunished. But this is near the end. The Zionist dream of an ethnically, religiously homogenous state was shattered by the Zionists themselves with their insatiable hunger for land. In their own hands, they created a binational state, a state where half of the population are not Jewish and are not Israeli, but are Palestinian. True, they have no rights. It's true that they're never counted. But this will change, and it'll change sooner than you think. The nonviolent resistance movement in towns and villages in Palestine will prevail. In places like Beit Umar, in Bilayin, in Abi Saleh, in Silwan, in Lin, in Sheikh Jarrah, Masra, and others. Dear friends, Palestinians and Israelis who are committed to justice and to democracy, organize nonviolent marches every single week. Many of you know this. And this is why those of us here who do believe in justice and do believe in democracy are optimistic. Because these people, these grassroots leaders, are dedicated and relentless. I'm going to give you two examples of such leaders, Palestinian leaders. The first one is a gentleman by the name of Khaled Abu Awad. Khaled Abu Awad is from the town of Beit Umar. His brother Yusuf was shot by a soldier at the Beit Umar checkpoint in October of 2000. And today Khaled is the head of the Palestinian side, the Palestinian branch of the Bereaved Families Forum. He's a peace activist, he does this full time. Well, here's a story. On November 11, 2004, Yasser Arafat died. His funeral took place a couple of days later in Ramallah, with smaller ceremonies and observances all over the West Bank, for those who couldn't make it to Ramallah. It was a solemn day for Palestinians and for many others around the world. The Israeli army was supposed to keep a low profile and allow Palestinians to mourn the death of their leader. The army received clear orders to avoid entering the city centers and the villages. But in Beit Umar, soldiers in an army jeep, decided not to adhere to the order and went screeching through town like a bully craving attention. Residents of Beit Umar were leading a peaceful procession of mourning and a symbolic funeral, and as one might expect, the jeep's presence ignited the atmosphere. A few young people threw stones, and the soldiers responded with live ammunition. The results were two casualties. Jameel Omar, a 19-year-old student, was killed immediately. Muayyad Al-Hawa, the son of Khaled, was shot in the head by a 5.56 caliber bullet and was laying on the ground, bleeding. But the soldiers blocked the ambulance from evacuating him. At the time that this was happening, Khaled himself was in northern Israel in a room full of Israeli high school students with an Israeli member of the bereaved family's forum. Boaz, his name is Boaz. He and Boaz were there to speak about reconciliation. This is what they do. They explain that the cycle of violence which has cost so many lives can and must be stopped, and that real dialogue has to take its place. Suddenly, Boaz was called out of the room. He returned immediately with his face pale and serious. He approached Khaled and whispered that his son Muayyad had been shot in the leg and injured. Now, for Khaled, this was very familiar. 4 years earlier, he was told that his brother was shot and injured, only to realize that he was dead and he arrived at the hospital. So one can imagine what was going on through his head when he heard that his son was shot. The presentation ended, of course, and Khaled and Boaz were about to leave, but then Khaled stopped at the door. This is a true story. He turned to the students, who of course were shocked, glued to their seats as this drama was unfolding in front of their very eyes. And Khaled said this. He said, "Whatever happens, even if the worst happens, even if I lost my son, we must never lose hope, we must never stray away from the path of reconciliation. These are the kinds of people that are leading this. These are the kind of Palestinians that are leading this." I've got a story for you. I have another story for you about a gentleman by the name of Osama Ramin. Osama Ramin contracted polio as a young boy. He was a very serious limp. He was arrested and he sat in Israeli prison for many years. He became a leader of the Fatah within the prison. And when he was released, he co-founded an organization called Combatants for Peace. These are Israeli and Palestinian combatants who refuse to fight, who refuse to engage in violence and believe in reconciliation. An incredible, incredible group of people. We're talking about pilots. We're talking about officers. We're talking about leaders who one would follow pretty much anyway. Now, in December, in 1997, the same year my niece Madar was killed, another little girl was born, Abir, the daughter of Hassan and Sarwa Ramin. On the morning of January 16, 2007, Abir asked her parents for permission to play with her friends after school. Hassan said, "No, you have to come back from after school, you have to come home right away." Abir answered with the touching and innocent words of an annoyed 10-year-old, "Well, I'm going to be late." As it turned out, Abir was late that day, but not because she met her friends. An Israeli soldier saw her walking home from school, hand in hand with her 12-year-old sister. He took aim, and he shot her in the head. When I heard the news, I was under the impression that Abir was seriously wounded, but there was hope. So I called Hassan immediately at the hospital, and I asked her, "How is she doing?" "She just died," he said to me quietly. And apparently, I was the first one to hear him utter those words. You see, in our shared homeland, there is no law that protects Palestinians, not even 10-year-old girls, not even children. Israeli soldiers brutally and willingly enforced the occupation because the Zionist education system taught them that the life of a Palestinian is worthless. In Berlin, some of you may have heard that name, soldiers fired tear gas in a frenzy of violence that knows no boundaries. And just a week after I was there, the amounts of tear gas used was enough to kill, and of course they did kill, 36-year-old Jawahar Rahma, who was killed from tear gas inhalation. In Abi Saleh, another beautiful spot in the West Bank, where settlers have made their ugly mark, local Palestinians march every week, and the clumsy and brutal Israeli army reservists armed to the teeth, have to face the undaunted courage of the mothers and the children who want the soldiers and the settlers out of their land and out of their lives. In East Jerusalem, just outside the walls of the Old City and not far from the Jewish quarter, sits the neighborhood of Sinwan, with close to 50,000 residents. Israel wants to expel families from Sinwan in order to build an archaeological park that glorifies the Jewish past. They claim that King David conquered and built a city there some 3,000 years ago, and of course they hope to find remnants of the city under the homes of the people of Sinwan. So thousands of families may have to leave so that Israel can build a park to glorify a conquest that took place 3,000 years ago. Of course, never mind that not a shred of evidence exists that such a king ever lived, any more than there's any evidence that the world was created in 6 days. But in Israel, the past trumps the present. Israel is a state that wants to eliminate the existence of people who live on their land to solidify the myth of a glorious past. But Palestinians constantly and stubbornly interfere with the Zionist myth-making. And so the Palestinians, men, women, children, the elderly, their schools, their mosques, their churches, their ancient cemeteries, all evidence of their existence must be destroyed so that Zionist claims to exclusive rights to the land can be substantiated. So those of you here that wish to associate yourself with Zionism in AIPAC and to drape yourself in the Zionist flag, this flag that has come to symbolize intolerance and hate, racism and brutality, you feel free to do so. But know this, when the trials begin, when the tribunals take their seat, when the Truth and Reconciliation Commission begins its work, and when you're finally shamed into admitting that you were wrong, remember to go down on your knees and beg forgiveness from the people you have wronged. Remember, you won't be able to say that you didn't know. Remember that we watched you dance as others were counting the dead. Remember, and never forget, that you and I and all these people were here tonight because I won't forget you, and they won't forget you. And worst of all, your conscience will not let you forget that you draped yourself in the flag, you supported the killing, and you mocked the bereaved. The rest of us will move on, and along with the rest of the Middle East, we will follow the example of the brave people of Egypt, and we will create something that is truly going to be a tremendous accomplishment. Democratic, secular state in our shared homeland. A state where Muslims, Christians, and Jews live as equals. A shared state where every vote counts, and where people can raise their children to love their diverse homeland with its multitude of cultures, its rich history, and its promising future. There is a misguided assumption that sharing the land means nations have to be enemies, but this is not true. Israelis and Palestinians will join together in their shared homeland, and they will form something that is greater than the sum of its parts. Thank you all very much.
Staying nice and peaceful and civil and not disrupting our speaker. We appreciate it. We would like to keep that environment and climate going, please. We're going to be doing a question and answer session, and we would like to have you all take the next 5 minutes or so to please write down your questions, and we will be collecting them on the sides of the aisles, and then we will be reading them off so that Miko can answer them for you. Okay?
Yeah, paper.
Yes.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Well, that's the question I feel everybody's asking right now. out. I think there's no question that there is. There's talk about a million men march across from one side of the wall to another. The Palestinians have had these nonviolent marches recently for years now. Having seen the impact that these marches can have, you know, is very, very empowering. So there's no doubt in my mind that what's happening all around Israel is going to happen in Israel and Palestine. And it's definitely going to have a positive effect everywhere.
In 2000, during the Oslo talks, why did Arafat reject the creation of Palestine?
Well, Arafat did not reject the creation of Palestine. Arafat rejected, well, let me look back here. In the mid-1970s, the notion or the idea of creating a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza was formed after the Six-Day War, like I mentioned in my comments. Eventually, the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, accepted this, and Arafat supported it. This meant the creation of a Palestinian state in the entire West Bank and the Gaza Strip, including East Jerusalem. For that, Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian leadership were willing to give up what they saw as the entire 80% of Palestine that was taken by Israel. Until Israel was created, that place was Palestine. Israel was created, and thousands of people were thrown out. So, it all depends on how you look at it, of course, but this was a huge compromise. The Palestinian leadership was accepting 20% of their homeland, 20% of their homeland, to build a state in order to end the conflict. By the time the summit in Camp David in the year 2000 came along, it was clear that Israel had no intentions of ever allowing the Palestinians to build a state in the West Bank. They allowed them certain parts of the West Bank. So for example, the entire Jordan River Valley, which makes up about a third of the West Bank, was off the table. Israel will not negotiate that. That's a third of the West Bank. The settlements, massive settlements that were built east of Jerusalem and practically cut the West Bank in half. That is out of the question. There's no negotiating on that. The major settlement blocks and the roads connecting to them, that was not negotiable. So what was left, what Arafat refused, was a piecemeal, like a little coffee stain on the map, little bits and pieces of some kind of autonomy in those areas for Palestinians. In refusing this, he was very consistent. He, for 30 years, up to the day he died, was consistent in saying, the Palestinian leadership agrees to peace with Israel on the basis of a two-state solution, which means the entire West Bank and the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem, which again is only about 20% of their historic homeland. So when Camp David came around, what he refused was a lot less than that. That was maybe 20% of that. So there was no surprise that he refused it, and I don't think he made a mistake. I think he did the right thing. We're doing questions like this.
Since Gaza is no longer occupied, what is the legacy of the government towards human rights for women, gays, Jews, and Christians?
Well, to say that Gaza is not occupied is really a joke. Ariel Sharon pulled the Jewish settlers out of Gaza unilaterally, so that he could impose the siege on Gaza. A more effective siege and a more effective blockage of Gaza. Israeli attacks and Israeli assaults on Gaza are not something new.
very beginning, from the very beginning of the establishment of the state of Israel, we can see a whole history of attacks on Gaza. Even though, for the most part, Gaza is an area with refugees. I mean, at least more than half of the population of Gaza are refugees from other places in Palestine.
Answer the question.
So to say that Gaza is not occupied is a complete misrepresentation. To say that Gaza is not occupied is a complete misrepresentation of the facts. Israel controls everything that goes on in Gaza. The flow of weapons into Gaza, it controls. It controls anything that goes in and out in terms of food, water, medicine, you name it. And everything is rationed, of course. So I don't accept the premise that Gaza is not occupied. Gaza is occupied, and everything that takes place in and around Gaza is controlled by Israel. And until that changes, I don't see how any discussion can be made seriously about what goes on inside Gaza. When Israel allows the Gazans the freedom, then we can talk about that.
What about the
people of Hamas oppressing
its own people? Excuse me. If you ask the question, we will read the question. The speaker is here to answer the question to the best of his ability. If he does not answer it to your liking, we are sorry. However, if you are disrespectful and you speak out, we are asking that everyone be respectful and stay civil. If you cannot do that, we ask you to please leave or we will have you leave. Okay?
Okay, so these two questions are similar, so I'm going to read them both, and then you can answer it. Were the Israelis seeking land in Gaza when they brought in bombs? What response would have been appropriate to the rockets from Gaza? And what do you think propelled Israelis to take the measures they have? The repercussion of actions is a two-way street, not one-sided.
Well, the way to solve the problem, the Israeli-Palestinian problem, and Gaza is not separate from the entire solution. The notion that we can somehow pick and choose little bits of the conflict and solve them individually is absurd. Gaza, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, the Galilee, this is all part of the same problem, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Two nations, roughly divided in half, who occupy and share the same homeland. The way to respond to the resistance is by stopping the occupation, is by allowing freedom, is by allowing the two sides to sit, and this, by the way, is something that's never happened. Allow the two sides to sit as equals and determine their future together. This is something that's never happened. Israel has always been the power. Israel has always had the army and its huge, massive war machine in control. So it's not just a question of how do we stop the rockets from Gaza? How do we stop the violence here or there? The entire thing has to be resolved. Because it's not going to work if you just solve one little piece or another. They've tried that many, many years. You need to resolve the entire thing. And the way to resolve the entire problem is by allowing complete freedom, creating a complete democracy, complete equal rights between all the people that reside between the West Bank and between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. A completely secular, pluralistic democracy. It's not a Jewish state, it's not an Arab state, it's not a Muslim state, it's a state. Within that state, you have Jews, within that state, you have Palestinians, you have Muslims, you have Christians, and so forth. So this is the solution to the entire problem.
The next question is, when was your foundation granted 501 status?
I'm sorry?
Your foundation, when was it granted 501?
The 501c3?
Yeah.
I don't remember the date, 6 months ago or something?
We all know that within the Jewish community, you are taking an unpopular view. How has this affected you and your family, and how are you dealing with it?
It hasn't affected me in any way. So there's nothing to deal with. Thank you for your concern.
Why is a two-state solution now impossible?
Two-state solution is impossible for several reasons. The main reason is Israel has built massively, massively in the West Bank. When they say settlements, a lot of people think, oh, a little town here, a little village there. That's nonsense. Imagine taking, I don't know, Rancho Bernardo, Poway, and Rancho Penasquitos, and asking everybody to leave. That's what the settlements are like. Settlements are major, major metropolises with malls and schools and highways. It's not something you can just ask people to leave. It's not going to happen. There is no more West Bank. There is no more West Bank. There is no more way to delineate the West Bank from the rest of the country. Those populations are completely mixed. Of course, there's segregation. Of course, there's inequality. But you can no longer separate one part of the country and say, okay, designating this as a Jewish part or a Palestinian part. It's no longer possible. Besides the fact that even if they did do it, it wouldn't solve anything. I mean, it would be a poor solution at this point. At this point, anyway.
Someone's thanking you here. Thank you, Miko. Can you please go over some of the injustices of Arab Palestinians who are Israeli citizens? What rights do they have?
Well, I don't want to get into it, but that's a topic for a whole presentation. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, there are about 24 laws in the Israeli law books that discriminate between Arabs or the Palestinians who are Israeli citizens. But the segregation is obvious, the allocation of funds, the allocation of water, the allocation of funds for education, the allocation for development of cities and towns and so forth. It goes on and on and on. I mean, like I said, it's an entire presentation.
What is a Zionist versus someone that is Jewish? And do you think Egypt will progress and help Palestinians?
What is a Zionist versus someone that is Jewish? Okay. Well, that's actually a very good question. Zionists are people who believe in the creation of a state for the Jews in historic Israel. That's what Zionism is, you know, in short. Now you've got all kinds of different shades of Zionism, but that's really what Zionism is about. Many, many Jews are not Zionists. When the Zionists began, most of the Jews thought they were crazy and didn't want to have anything to do with them. And it's true to today. Many Jews who live in other countries are not Zionists. Some Jews who live in Israel are not Zionists. So not all Jews believe that the creation of the state of Israel, the creation of a Jewish state in historic Israel is important or is the right thing. So that's the differentiation between being Zionist and being Jewish. Whether or not Egypt helps, what happened, nobody really knows exactly what's going to happen in Egypt, I think. So far, it seems that the liberation movement is working well. They managed to get rid of Mubarak, but they haven't quite managed to get rid of the group that is still in power. Of course, they're saying that this is just a transition period, and at the end of the transition period, they will rewrite the constitution, and they will have free, fair elections, and they will create the kind of atmosphere that will allow for a multi-party system and so forth. I think, ultimately, the reason the Zionists and AIPAC were so supportive of Mubarak and so anti the popular movement, the freedom movement, was because Mubarak was bribable. Having a tyrant is very convenient. He's bribable. And so for the bribes that he received, he was willing to make sure that the southern border of Rafah was closed. If you have a democracy in Egypt, an elected government, they might not agree to that. Which, of course, if you believe in freedom and you believe in democracy and justice, you think it's a good thing. So hopefully things will turn out in Egypt as we all hope it to be, and it will become a real democracy, and then that will definitely impact the situation in Gaza and probably the situation in Palestine.
The next question is, under your theory of a completely free and democratic society for all people to achieve peace, who or what organization is responsible for law and order, specifically as it pertains to controlling and ending terrorist acts of Hamas?
The same authority that's going to make sure that there are no terrorist acts perpetuated by the Israeli army will probably make sure that there are no terrorist acts by anybody else. The idea is that there's a state in which everybody has a share, a state in which everybody is free to vote, free to live, free to worship, and free to express themselves. Freedom does not encourage terrorism. Freedom is the antidote. Now, there's been a couple of questions about Hamas terrorism. Hamas terrorism is, first of all, compared to Israeli terrorism, for example, it's hardly worth mentioning. So once Israeli terrorism stops, I'm sure the Hamas terrorism will stop as well.
Can you explain more about who AIPAC is and what they do? Have you ever been involved with AIPAC?
It's Israeli lobby in America.
That's it?
We'll talk to some of these people here. I'm sure they'll be happy to provide
you. Pathetic. You mentioned some sort of biblical prophecy underground in Jerusalem. That is their reason for excavation. Maybe they have different aims. To the extent of your knowledge, could the Zionists be preparing for an awaited Messiah?
There's a lot of things so I have to ask.
Zionism is a secular movement, not a religious movement. Zionism is a secular national movement, it's not a religious movement. And although Zionists like to use the Bible as though it was a history book, and they like to believe that King David and King Solomon and all these people really lived, it's more like mythology. It's not a religious kind of movement. In fact, a great many Orthodox Jews who are vehemently against Zionists,
I feel you mainly address Palestinian and Israeli Zionist views. How does U.S. foreign policy relate to this?
Well, the American foreign policy supports Zionism. None of this, Israel would not be able to do what it's doing had it not received a blank check from America. I mean, everybody saw I think it was in Cairo, when they looked at the canisters of the tear gas and it said made in the USA. Come with me to Berlin and I'll show you mountains of those. After Jawahar Abraham was killed by tear gas, I think it was December, the Israeli activists picked up a whole boxes full of those canisters and took them to the residence of the American ambassador, saying thank you but no thank you, please take them back. So, you know, everybody was shocked when they saw those Made in America canisters in Cairo. Palestine is full of them. The bombs that are dropped, everything is American made, and everything is paid for by American tax dollars. So none of this, and this problem could have probably been solved a long time ago if it had not been for American foreign policy.
How do you envision the first step in uniting the people of Israel and Palestine?
Go back to the previous question. After my dad retired from the military, he would come here and he would speak locally. As a retired general, he would beg the Americans to tell the representative to stop selling weapons. And there's always this talk about the rubber bullets against protesters. And supposedly these rubber bullets are okay because they're rubber bullets. And he used to carry a rubber bullet in his pocket, and he would show it, and he would scratch off the rubber. He could scratch off the rubber to see the real bullet under it. And this is all American made. You know, next time somebody asks why they hate us, you know, you might want to think about that.
What was the question? How do you bring it together? I don't know how you bring it together. This is very difficult. What I do, the segregation between the two communities is so deep. And the Zionist Israeli education system is so racist that it would take, it's going to be a very difficult process. But I don't think revolutions like this happen because the majority agrees. Revolutions happen in spite of the majority disagreeing. Most whites in apartheid in South Africa didn't want apartheid to end, but it ended. What is going on between Israelis and Palestine that is very positive is the weekly protests in many, many places all over the West Bank. And these are Israelis and Palestinians marching hand in hand. So the tear gas that is being fired at them by the soldiers and the rubber bullets or the live ammunition is fired at Israelis and Palestinians. And the Israeli activists are very resilient and they're very determined. And so that is a place where the two places, where the two meet. But for an Israeli to cross over into the West Bank, first of all, there's a wall, this imposing structure. And then you've got these towers. And then there's armed soldiers, armed to the teeth. It's frightening. And then there are signs the size of billboards in Hebrew. Signs in Hebrew that say, this road leads to Palestinian territories. Going into Palestinian territories will endanger your life and is a felony. And there's at least two or three exclamation marks after. So this is what Israelis see as they should want to reach out. The Palestinians are not permitted to come into Israel anyway. So to find a point where the two can meet is very difficult. It requires some ingenuity. And a lot of Israelis don't care, like myself. I mean, I cross it back and forth. Sometimes I'm arrested, but being an Israeli and you're arrested, it's not the end of the world. So. But the process of reaching out is very difficult because of the segregation.
The next question asks, do you think that the example given by the Egyptians may tame the conduct of the Israelis towards the Palestinians?
I don't think it will occur right away. I think it will probably be effective eventually. I think the revolution will take, it will have its impact. I don't know if it's going to be anything anytime soon.
This one is, how did your father's views influence you as a child, and how has this affected you recently?
Good question. You have to read the book when it comes out. Growing up, in Israel, the army is everything. In Israel, the army is God. And I say it with all seriousness. So if your father is a general, I mean, there's nothing more than that. There can be nothing higher than that. It's so impactful that it's hard to imagine. As I look back now, the names of all these, it's Huckabee Bean and all these names of these generals, all these famous people, this was the environment in which I grew up. But then the turn that my father took, as the war ended, as the barrels were still smoking, in saying that it's time immediately to allow the Palestinians to create a state in the West Bank and Gaza, immediately, as the war ended. And then a couple of years after that, talking about the PLO. Talking about the PLO in Israel in the 70s is like talking about Al-Qaeda here today or something. I mean, it was unheard of. They were terrorists. They were mean. They were killers. But of course, it allowed me to see that point of view. It was separate from what you get in the Israeli education system, which is very black and white. A point of view that says, well, there is another entity here. There are other people here. They do deserve rights. And then Palestinians within Israel developed a whole movement as well. There's Land Day, which is the day where they commemorate the confiscation of lands and so on and so forth within Israel. And when I travel today in Palestinian communities, whether in Israel or the West Bank,
His name still creates a lot of emotion. The response is always, really, you're the son of Matilda? The boy did so much for us. So it's still very impactful. It's still very impactful to this day.
Okay, so we have two more questions. Why do you think AIPAC has such a strong influence on the U.S. government, foreign relations with Israel?
The second one,
is a two-state solution an actual option, and will it actually work in your opinion, and if not, what do you think needs to happen?
Okay, well, I answered in my comments. Why AIPAC has such influence? You know, I don't know. A lot of times it reminds me of a bully in the playground. Why are people scared of a bully? Because he's a bully. Now, not everything that happens is the fault of AIPAC. I mean, America, the American arms industry makes a lot of money off of this. At least half the money, the $3 billion that goes to Israel in aid, comes back here in purchase of military equipment, of arms. You know those little canisters that say made in America? So a lot of that comes back here. So it's you know, America, the arms industry and the American government have an interest to keep this conflict alive. Why politicians of, I don't know, congressmen and senators and people, you know, just day to day are talking about AIPAC like it was this all powerful thing? I don't know. I think people are just naturally afraid of bullies. AIPAC is nothing more than a bully, and you stand up to it, and it backs off, and that's the only way to do it. So the more people stand up to AIPAC, the better things will be.
Okay, so Britt said that we're
going to
have a last call for questions. Okay, we'll do this question. Can you explain the prison system for Israel versus Palestinians in Israel? Like, the prison system for Israelis versus Palestinians in Israel.
Prison system?
Yeah.
Well, I can talk a little bit about the prison system for Palestinians. It's actually one of the most impressive aspects of Palestinian society and the Palestinian resistance is what takes place in the prisons among the Palestinian political prisoners. Now, these are not criminals, and the Israeli authorities know that they're not criminals. But over the span of 40-some-odd years that the occupation has taken place, the Palestinian prisoners movement has developed an amazing system in which Palestinian prisoners conduct their lives. I don't know if any of you read Nelson Mandela's book, The Long March Home, The Long March Home. He describes what it was like for him, how you can become a leader. How can a leader from within the prison impact politics outside the prison? I remember reading it, when it came out, you know, a long time ago. I was really impressed. In talking to Palestinians, many of my friends who were prisoners, almost all of them, you hear that story over and over and over again. There's a regiment of study. Because it was amazing. They come out of prison, they all speak Hebrew perfectly. They all know Israeli and Zionist history better than I do. They all speak English. Sometimes, depending on how long they have to sit, sometimes they speak French and German. And I'm going, how does this work? The regiment was created, and I talk about this at some length in my book. The regiment was created by several leaders who realized that this was going to be the destiny of many Palestinians. So they began putting together a college curriculum. They wrote books, and they would teach each other, and they have study groups, and they have political gatherings, and they have elections. It's all democratic, they have elections. And how you conduct elections when people are scattered in prisons all over the country, it's an incredible, incredible story. But everything is done democratic youth elections, and you've got the different factions within the political life outside the prison, represented within the prison as well. And so you've got the Fatah, you've got Hamas, you've got all the different groups, and they've got their own laws, and they've got their own, you know, code of behavior, and so on and so forth, which is very interesting. There are stories that go on and on and on. What is interesting, though, is when Israel realizes that somebody's a leader, they start moving them around. Hassam Rahim, whose daughter was killed here, he told me once that he's very short and he has a terrible limp because he had polio. So as he and the authorities suspected that he was somehow involved in the leadership of the prison. And they moved him around, finally they gave up. And they brought him back to his original cell. And he said it was one of the happiest moments of his life because he had all the correspondence with the other prisoners and the other political party under the flooring of his cell. So these are stories that are really quite remarkable. But the fact that Palestinian prisoners are held in prisons in Israel is a breach of international law. It's illegal for an occupying power to imprison people outside of their, where they were, of the country or the global area where they were in prison. So there's lots of breaches of international law that goes on.
Okay, so we're
going to
conclude with the program now. Please stick around if you want to ask any of the students or Justice Palestine readers any questions. Perhaps Nico might stay in that for a couple minutes. But the program is officially over. Thank you for coming. And